You're listening to The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, Tasmania's largest independent pop culture retailer. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au.
The Dice Men Cometh!
It's Thursday night, and here we are back in the studio for The Dice Men Cometh, episode 183.
Woo!
And Garth, there's some very exciting news about PAX.
Is there ever? I'm going.
So am I.
Oh, really? Oh, that's doubly exciting.
But not only are you going, Garth, this year,
yes,
you'll be a special person.
I know.
I've been a special person the last two times that I've been.
Yeah.
This time I get to be an ordinary person and you get to be a special person.
I get to be special. I keep telling people how special I am, but no one ever listens until now. So, yes, I am very proud to be on a very illustrious panel with luminaries in the Australian board gaming industry.
One of only, I think, three tabletop panels at PAX.
That's what I've heard so far, but they haven't released the schedule, so there could be some sneaky ones hiding away there. Who knows?
Okay.
But I'm on there with Alex. People will know Alex as part of the design team from Red Genie Games, who
the Brigade
that we've talked about, and his involvement with the TGDA,
yes,
which is pretty massive. Dice Lady Tanya.
Oh, yeah.
Jellybean Games artist par excellence. We've got Anna, who is part of the Defiant development team from, I guess they're in Queensland, and they've, in board gaming speak, they're all about Hand of Fate in conjunction with Rule and Make.
Fantastic.
Which is exciting. So they're the opponents. They're the people I don't really like. Just kidding. Or am
okay.
I? And then on my team, or the team that at least I'm a part of,
yes,
is Dan May, who was on the
he was on
team
my
last
panel
year,
yes,
as well.
From Good Games.
Exactly right. And a pretty talented artist there as well. So
yes,
that's fantastic. We've also got Derek, who we mentioned and we met at the 93 Made Games booth last
year.
So he's going to be on there. And then there'll be yours truly. And we're going to make up the against team. And the topic
what are you
that we're
against?
Talking about is old games versus new. So what's better? The old games, the classics, the games that everyone loves and wants to get to the table, or those new bits of tripe, no one has time for them, they're all just copycats, no one really wants to play them. So clearly, old is better, is that right? I mean,
well,
clearly
except,
as the oldest member of the Dice
of
Men,
course,
and the oldest member in the room, and generally the oldest person in any room.
Oldest is best, except, of course, tonight, Garth.
Okay.
We're talking about one very, very new game in this War of Mine, and then one quite new game in Feast for Odin.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about those. We've played them both lately.
We have. Could those games be really much further apart?
They're pretty different, that's for sure. I'm going to talk about some board game news.
Oh, there you go. Sounds like I'm just going to take the night off then.
Oh, and then we watched a film recently.
We have. And if we've got time, we'll even talk about the film, but we've got a hell of a lot to get through.
We do.
So, look, let's throw to a song. Before we do that, just want to say a big shout-out to Area 52, who are our sponsors for this week, the home of all of Tasmania's pop culture, be it board games, or those pops that you are just so addicted to, Mark.
Oh, Funko
or
Pops.
Comics. It's Thursday, so it's comic day again. If you are a geek, a nerd, or a really cool person in Hobart, go and pay them a visit on Elizabeth Street. Anyway, we're going to throw to a song, and then Mark's going to come back and talk everything there is about this hot game called This War of Mine.
Well, that was an interesting track, Garth.
Was it ever?
Who was that?
Oh, my God. That was an artist called Bat Piss.
Really?
Yes, and you are with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Yeah, that was Bat Piss. The song was called You Plus Me. I didn't understand any of the words, but anyway, that's fine.
I bet they're an Australian act, aren't they?
They are Australian.
Actually, I think I've heard of their album. What was it called again?
Oh, my God, it's called Rest in Piss. It's really new, though, 2017. Anyway.
There you go.
Let's get on to some board games, Mark.
We have been playing a game, and this one, we have been playing it right up until about a week ago or so.
Yeah.
We played it for actually, unlike a lot of the games we play, we played it quite a few times in a row.
I reckon we played it maybe, what, three nights in a week?
Yeah, and then we handed it over
more
to Leon, and then he's been playing it. And it is, of course, you know, we've been teasing it for weeks now, This War of Mine, the board game. Of course, it draws its inspiration very, very heavily from This War of Mine, the computer game.
Yes.
From 11-Bit Studios. And this was a Kickstarter, very successful Kickstarter. And we were all big fans of the video game, so we were hotly anticipating getting our hands on this one.
Yes, we were bugging Trent every other day to say, has it arrived
has
yet?
It
has
it arrived
yet? Has it arrived yet? Has it arrived yet? And then he sent us a photo of something like High Frontier 3rd Edition that he got, which I'm sure will be awesome, but we haven't had a chance to get that to the table
That's
yet.
That's right.
It's like, we want this game.
So This War of Mine, the board game, designed by Michael Orich and Jacob Wisniewski, produced by Awaken Realms and Asmodee just this year. And it's, as we said, it's the tabletop adaptation of the award-winning video game where you are a group of civilians trapped inside a city that's in the midst of civil war. Now, they don't say which one it is, but it's very heavily influenced by, I believe, Sarajevo and that particular, I guess it was a civil war, a war between factions. But basically, you're civilians not taking part in the war, but you're almost trapped in your...
Well, you're stuck in the city.
In your house during the day. And then of a night time, you were able to sneak out. Now, the video game, of course, handled this, and the board game does the same, where during the day, you're stuck in your house. What are you going to do? Well, of course, you're going to walk around and you're going to, like, dig through rubble because part of your house has collapsed to find useful things so you can make other useful things that will help you survive.
And I guess, first of all, for anyone who has played the computer game version, be it on your computer or on your iPad or anything like that, the board will be immediately recognizable because essentially it is the screen that you're looking at on the computer. It is the silhouette of your house.
Yes.
It is exactly the same. Yeah. And that immediately, for me, who has played the computer game a lot, it was just so wonderful to go straight into that, that atmosphere again, because immediately I was drawn in and gone, okay, I'm in for the ride.
And when I know when we first made something, I wanted to stick it in the kitchen because that's where I'd always stick. For example, the stove would automatically appear in the kitchen. But we're jumping ahead. So one of the things they actually say about the board game is it significantly broadens the original game's universe, and there really is the emphasis on the depth of the plot, getting into those human interactions driven by your instinct to survive. But also there is the group decision-making, because it's a cooperative game. You have the characters from the video game, but you are not playing. It's not like you play one character each. You each take it in turns as you go around the board to move and operate the whole group.
Yeah, you're always a collective. There is no betrayer.
No.
The game's the bloody betrayer in this case. But that immediately is something that sets this game a little bit apart from a lot of other co-op games, is that you're not emotionally tied to my character, my person. I don't have that vested interest in this one person. My job on my turn is to do the best possible things for the two or three or four characters that I've got in my board.
Yeah.
Because I want them to survive. I want them to live. I want them to eat. I want them to drink water. I want them to not get shot.
I must admit, I did have some emotional attachment to particularly Marco, just because in the computer game, he's the guy for me who was spent so long going out and gathering stuff.
Sure.
And he was good at that. So I was very sad when he, spoiler alert, got killed. But anyway, so in this game, you are merely trying to survive. Ostensibly until the war, till there's some sort of ceasefire or the war stops. Not necessarily permanently, but long enough at least maybe where you might be able to escape the city.
Yeah.
So during your struggle as the survivors, you will experience dramas connected with making extremely difficult decisions and choices, and you will have to face the consequences of your actions sooner or later. Survival itself often proves not to be enough, though, because you don't just want to survive at the cost of others, because you just die of a broken heart.
Yes.
You die of sadness.
Your empathy is really, really important.
So you have to be able to not only survive, but survive with the decisions that you've made. Now, I mentioned you have the day phase and the night phase. So in the day phase, what you're doing is you're doing normally, There are potentially three actions you can have in the day phase. However, depending on what state your characters are, how wounded they are, how low in morale they are, how sick they are, how hungry they are, how tired they are, you will generally lose actions. Now, I don't know if we've ever had a character, Garth, that actually got to take three actions.
No, I can't recall. And the damn thing is that even on turn one, round one, action one, they're already damaged people.
Yeah.
Because you're thrown straight into the middle of this situation. You're not starting the game, oh, this is my lovey-dovey share house where everyone is good and friendly and happy.
Have we got a video then?
Yeah, we're starting in the middle of this civil war and someone's already been injured or somebody's already starving or somebody's already really, really tired.
Yeah.
And you are just thrown headfirst into this.
And that's why, of course, your house is in complete disarray because there's been bombing and all sorts of stuff. So you've got various piles of rubble around the house behind locked doors that you have to go and dig up and discover. And, you know, simple things like you need a shovel to be able to dig rubble. Otherwise, it takes two people and it takes twice as long. You need to be able to pick locks or smash down doors. And sometimes, you know, the doors are so solid you can't. Just in your own house, to find useful stuff around, you know, bits of wood and electrical and mechanical componentry, water, of course, food, to be able to survive. And then to be able to turn the wood and the componentry into useful things. You start off with a pile of ideas that you can make, and then there are another pile of ideas you haven't had yet that you can think about for a while, and then you can bring those ideas into the pile of stuff you can make. Things like, and look, anyone who's played the computer game will know, you know, a stove, a heater, a trap to trap rats, because, of course, food is one of the hugest issues in this game. Trying to find food and get enough food to feed your party is a constant struggle.
Is it ever?
And you will always have people that are hungry. They're never sitting there with their hands in their bellies going, I can't eat another thing. That just does not happen in this game.
Oh, my God, no, it doesn't. And the thing is, you will play this game for as long as you want to, and very rarely, in fact, never, have I been involved in a game where you clear your house and make it good? There is always still rubble there that needs to be cleaned out. There is always a locked door that you haven't got a lockpick to be able to get through. It's one of those things that you think, oh, well, we'll just focus on this. We've got the whole day to clear this rubble and do this thing and make sure the house is respectable. Nah, you pretty quickly run out of actions because of your characters being so hurt in one way or another.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking at differences between the computer game and this, that is one thing. And I guess maybe because some of us play the computer game for a long time, is eventually your house is all cleared and there's sort of nothing left to do in the house except build new stuff that you find. In the game, there's always piles of rubble and locked doors and other things you can do. And of course, one of the things you can do is stick your head outside the door and see who's out there.
Yeah.
And sometimes you desperately need to do that because the people who are inside the door, they're not lasting and you need more people to come and fill the house. And that's always an exciting thing, you know, when you think, oh, maybe there'll be someone out there we can trade with. Maybe we'll get some food. God forbid, maybe we might get some bandages because we keep getting shot.
Or another survivor, which could be good. But they could arrive and they'd be horribly damaged and they go,
and it's
really
another mouth to feed. Yeah. That's the thing. So you can do all those things during the day and then you get to, I think, the most fun part of this game is the night phase.
Yeah, well, look, it really is the crux of the game.
Yeah.
So when I hadn't even played this game, I was expecting the meat of the game to be all about the day phase where it is doing those actions and getting your house as strong and protected as possible.
Yeah.
But really, it's not. It's probably about a, I don't know, 80, 20 or 30, 70, where you're spending that time on the house, but then you're right, it is all about the night phase, which is where a whole bunch of interesting stuff happens.
Yeah, and what we didn't mention, and I'll go back a couple of steps, this game, you, a bit like Legends of Andor we talked about, you play it straight out of the rule book. There's no rule book to memorize before you start playing. It's basically, this is how you set up the board. then one person does this, and then you pass this book to the next person. There's all these arrows, and every time there's an arrow, you pass the book. And then each person gets to do a thing. So in the day phase, it's one person does a round of actions, then they pass the book to the next person. The next person does a round of actions for all the characters. And it's really clever. It's very much, you know, that tutorial style we mentioned, like a computer game where the game itself steps you through the rules, even to the fact that a lot of the rules, not a lot of the rules, but some of the rules aren't even in the book.
No.
They're buried in the book of scripts with all the paragraphs, and you're referred to that when you need to know it. So you're not blown away by, oh, my God, there's all these rules.
Yeah, and another thing is that with co-ops, there is always the risk that you'll have the one-alpha gamer, Mark, who will try and tell everyone what to do, Mark, and it will suffer for that. But this game explicitly states in the very, very thin rule book that whoever is the active player or the mission leader or whatever the terminology is, they make all the final decisions after consultation, good or bad, with the group. And no one else apart from the person holding the rule book, who is the mission leader, is allowed to touch the board, touch the components, or do any interaction with that the game at all. And I think that should be implemented in every game that I play with you, because that would just make everyone's enjoyment that much higher.
It is a very clever mechanic. So let's go back now. So to the night phase. So firstly, one player will decide who's going out gathering, who's going to stay and guard the house. If you're lucky enough to have enough people to be able to spread between that, maybe one person might get to lie down in a bed to if you've made one, to recover some, I was going to say hit points, to get to not be so fatigued. But usually there's no time for resting because you know that someone's going to come, well, not knock on the door, they're going to come and try and break in and steal your stuff. But you also need one or more people to go out scavenging because, as we said, that's the meat of the game. That's when you find all the stuff you need to eat, to drink, to make into the stuff to make your house better, to trade, to smoke, to imbibe in the case of, you know, alcohol, to get your spirits back up again. And the way they've done it, and, you know, this is the bit I didn't really know how they would do it in the game. How they've done it, though, with a deck of cards where you, depending on which of the, there's three locations to choose from, they're on cards. And they will change every now and again.
And they're all from the video game as well. Yes. So you've got deserted houses, you've got a ruined school, you've got
Sniper Junction.
So they're all familiar to anyone who's played the video game as well.
And those cards will tell you some of the things you're likely to find in those places. So, of course, if you're going for food or if you're going for medicine, you can try and pick where it might give you a better chance to find it. But you never really know. So you pick which place you're going to, you pick who's going, you pick which stuff they're taking with them, whether they're going to take the one and only shovel you have or the one and only weapon, and leave the people at home unarmed to fend off the bandits. You know, and you wonder if you're going to come back home and find them dead on the doorstep, the bandits or the party. And then, depending on which place you go to, it will tell you how many cards to draw from the, I can't remember the name of the deck.
Is it just the exploration deck?
So you draw a certain amount of cards from the deck, and basically then you'll just resolve them one at a time. However, often you're faced with a choice. If you want to do the thing on this card, then you've got to bury a certain amount of other cards. So it's like basically you've got a certain amount of time to explore, and if you're going to stop and do this particular thing, that's going to chew through a bit of your time, which is represented by throwing out other cards of that exploration deck.
Yeah, which is interesting. There's two things about the whole scavenging phase that I found really captivating. The first one is that in order to potentially do a really fantastic action on the card, which you don't usually know what the outcome's going to be, but it might be get rid of three other exploration cards to break down this door and go into another room, or to go upstairs or downstairs or do a trade or what have you.
Yeah, or just even just talk to the people who are in the area and find out what's happening.
That's right. You don't know what the outcome's going to be, but what you do know is it's going to limit the number of exploration cards left for you to choose. And then the second thing that happens, and I'm sure that's the next thing on your list, is that bloody noise track.
Oh, yes. And it so reminded me of making noise, bring the noise, out of Dead of Winter. So when you do things in these various different rooms that you're exploring for, often you've got to either increase the noise level because you're, of course, making noise while you're rabbiting around, or you've got to check for noise, so to see that if people have heard you, and you roll a D8. And, of course, when you start, the noise starts at one, but each thing you do, it's moving up and up and up. And if you get that noise or below, it means people have heard you. And then you go to the, I can't remember the name of that other
deck. Residence deck.
The residence deck, that's right. So then basically you will have a resident or some residents come along and find you. Now, they could be friendly people who are just scavenging around themselves.
They won't be.
They could be hobos who were asleep in the corner going, oh, what are you doing here?
No, that won't happen.
Or they could be soldiers, of course, coming and saying, what are you doing here? You got to go.
Or thugs.
Or, oh, you're taking stuff? I'm going to shoot you. Like, it's crazy. It's wacky. It's zany.
And it's so unpredictable. Oh, so the thing is, you're right, there are residents, there are people, there are drunks, there are all kinds of residents that you will run into. But you got no bloody idea of what that's going to be until you reveal the card. But look, we've been talking for a fair old bit about this. So I think what we're going to have to do is throw to a song.
Okay.
And then come we back, will come back more? Because there is a hell of a lot more we need to talk about in this one because, oh my God. It is a storytelling game in a half.
Yeah.
So anyway, you are with the Dice Men Cometh. There are at least 2/4, 1/2, 40, 20ths, other way around, 80th.
Anyway, the two most important
ones. It's still Edge Radio 99.3 FM, and we will be right back after this song. Thanks, Area 52, for supporting us. We'll be back in a moment. Oh, dearie me, that was called Defenders of the Faith by Tyrant. A Tassie act.
Garth, how the hell did that get in there?
Oh, my God. I think someone must have been in control of that because that is by Neil.
Neil Steele Wilson.
Steele Neil, who runs the show after our show. So if you want to hear more of that, stay listening after this radio show, but we'll edit him out in the podcast, so don't worry about that. Anyway, Mark, you got a hell of a lot more to talk about with this war of mine.
Well, of course, because, you know, we were talking about scavenging.
Yeah.
You're going out, you're going through the scavenging deck, and at the end of the scavenging, you basically look at what's your carrying capacity. Depending on how many people you've got, they've got a carrying capacity. You add those numbers up together, and that's how much stuff you can take back. And one of the things I think that saves you in this game is that you're always allowed to take water,
yep,
wood, and components to basically fill the empty slots. And
but
often
there's never going to be empty slots.
No, but often it's a case of, you know, all that good stuff we found, throw half of it away because we've got to take some water back, particularly water.
Most of the characters, because you'll start the game with, is it one red character, which is generally one of the bigger names, for lack of a better term, that you will notice again from the video game, and then two grey cards or whatever they are, and they will tell you what their carrying capacity is when they go scavenging. But the best that I can recall is maybe six or seven weight worth of stuff. Yeah. And that's not much. So you are going to be scavenging. In some cases, you'll get to go through 12 or 14 cards in the exploration deck, and you might end up getting 20 plus more of weight when you're trying to collect mechanical parts or bottles of alcohol or weapons or bullets or food or bandages.
And this, I think, this is one of the key differences with the video game because I remember Marco, for example.
Your friend Marco.
He could carry, I think, like 15
That's the number
things
that springs
in the
to
video
my mind
game.
As well, yeah.
So you could take a whole lot of stuff back, which then meant because you had sort of, at least it felt like, you had more time during the day. You could make more things in your house to catch food, catch water, listen to the radio, play
sit
a guitar,
down.
You know.
Sit
on
down
the chair.
In a chair and feel good about yourself, but it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Now, you can overcome that because if you've got enough people in your group, you can send two people scavenging or even three if you wanted to, and all of their combined carry weights will add together so that you can bring more stuff home. But that then impacts the people who are stuck at home.
And, of course, what happens then is And not that these things happen at the same time, but after you resolve the scavenging phase, before those people come back with the stuff they've chosen to keep, you resolve the...
Night raid.
The night bullets.
Oh, man.
And your one or two or no people that you left behind have to face whatever's coming, whether it's looters, whether it's thugs, whether it's just hobos.
Yeah, starving people.
But usually you will, A, take some wounds, B, lose a heap of stuff, and sometimes C, not survive the night when you're in the night raid phase. And it's really tough. So you're out gathering all this stuff, but when you come home, half the stuff you'd left behind was gone. So, I mean, we even found that we were loading up the people going out to scavenge because, well, the worst case is we can throw it away ourselves as opposed to having
been
stolen.
Well, we were loading them up a lot of the time with the zero weight items.
Yes.
Because, look, I think that was gamifying the game a bit much. That's the gamer coming out in us. But the thing for me that differentiated the night phase in the board game versus the video game is, to this day, after all the plays of this game, I'm still yet to see just a quiet night. Just nothing happens. Like, everything's fine.
Yep.
The worst thing that happens is the person who's on guard duty gets a bit more sleepy.
Yeah.
Just doesn't happen because something bad has happened every single night.
Yeah.
And that just speaks volumes about what this game is, because God damn, it's a tough game.
Oh, it's so difficult. That's absolutely right. So then after, if you've survived the night raids, after the scavengers come back, then you have, I guess, the bit that ties everything together, because you have the what they call the fate cards, which is when you'll decide, basically, people have to eat and drink.
They do.
People who are sick or wounded may or may not get worse or better.
Or just the same.
Or not do anything. And then generally you'll get to perhaps read some paragraphs.
Yeah.
And
if people can't have their smoke in the morning, their morning durry,
yes.
or if they love a cup of coffee and they can't have it, well, that's going to make them miserable, so they'll just lose an action.
Yes.
Oh, it's tough.
But I really look – so you've got the – you've probably got the three cards. You've got the fate cards, the event cards, and the chapter cards.
Narrative actions.
Tying all the story together. And look, I thought it was really clever how you've got those colours cards. So you've got the Book of Scripts, which is all the paragraphs. There are hundreds and hundreds of paragraphs.
Thousands of paragraphs. Yes. Yeah.
And then on the fate cards, or the narrative action cards, it will tell you to draw a colour card. That will have a colour. And then on other cards, it will have all the different colours, and each of the colours will be associated with a paragraph number. And one of the ways you can dial up or dial down the graphicness, if you like, of the violence and the sort of disturbing stuff that happens is you can leave out particular colour cards to make it not so hard, not so nasty, not so violent, which I thought was a really clever way of doing it without sort of having to change the game at all.
Well, it's very similar to Dead of Winter, which, again, we mentioned last week, in that you're able to take out cards from the Crossroads deck that are a little bit more adult. And this War of Mine, oh my God, if you are playing this with younger people...
Then stop!
Stop, but take those various colour cards out, because there is stuff in the Book of Scripts that is incredibly gory or violent or horrific.
Yeah, or really disturbing.
Disturbing, yeah. It is no holes barred. And again, anyone who's played the video game knows that those scenarios happen, so it should be of no surprise. But there's a reason that this game, I think in America, is rated 18+.
Yeah. Not surprising. And so, you know, those cards, so you've got you're generally playing three chapters, and then within each chapter there's three, what are they called, event cards?
Just event cards that pop up.
So you've almost got like 9 days you're playing through. And those are tying the story together, giving you sort of short-term objectives to work towards, futilely in some cases, but really pulling that story together, tightening it, creating that dramatic tension of, oh my God, we've only got one more night to go and find these the medicine that we've got to give the looters before they come and kill us or whatever. This game is such an experience. I mean, having said how graphic and disturbing some of the content is, it is a gripping story. And even though, like, the first time we played, I think we played for 4 hours, and that was only like, we only got through a third of the game. It was a learning game. We were taking it very easily and, you know, chatting. But the time just flew. We were gripped by the story. We loved how the game plays. I just can't say enough good things about this.
Yeah, so a couple of other things about this game. First of all, it has a save function.
Oh, yes.
So you are meant to play 3 chapters, as you said, Mark, but playing all 3 chapters will take you 5, 6, maybe even more hours, and not a lot of people can dedicate the time to that at the best of time. Mm-hmm. But for a game like this, which is really quite emotionally involved, you may not want to stick around for that long.
Yes.
Because the second thing about this game that I find captivating is that, comparing it to games we talked about last week in our storytelling segment, none of those have got anything on this in terms of struggle, hardship, merely surviving. And it needs to be very clearly explained to anyone who's going to play this game that this is not a game that you go out to win. This is a game that you go out to survive and try and last as long as you can. Yeah. And that is very, very, very different to almost any other game that is out there. And understandably so, there have been very mixed reviews on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we're not used to this. We're not used to struggle and hardship and graphic violence or graphic disturbing imagery in this case. This is one of a very few breed of game which is truly adult.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, like, I don't want people to think that I am, you know, reveling in the graphic violence and disturbing imagery. It's the opposite, really. Like, I'm so drawn by the story, and I'm so drawn by helping these characters just to survive, just to stay not even happy, just to stay miserable enough that they don't want to kill themselves because it's got so bad, you know, to or have them bleed out in a chair in the kitchen while they're waiting for their friends to come back with medicine. But it just is enthralling to try and survive. You're on the seat of your pants the whole time. And so many times we found ourselves where, you know, we had a starting group of three, two of them would end up either wandering off into the dark, never to be seen again, or dead through their wounds, or dead through disease, or dead through their own hand because they couldn't cope with it anymore. And then, you know, we'd be have to find some hope that some new people would be able to be found to help get us through. It's a struggle.
Is it ever?
But it's how do you say it's an enjoyable struggle? It's just there's something satisfying about surviving, just surviving, just like there is in the video game. And I think if you've played the video game and you found that satisfying, this creates it in a board game way, but the same but different. Like there's enough different elements that I want to play both, and they're different enough.
Yeah, well, the video game is a solo experience. You're playing it by yourself, and the characters that you're playing are your fellow players, for lack of a better term. Whereas what I love about this game, and clearly I really, really, really enjoy it, is I love the fact that everyone around the table says it plays up to 4, but it doesn't really matter how many players you've got because you're all just doing an action as the lead player, so we can quite easily play it with 5 or 6. But you're always controlling all of the characters at one time. No one's going to make a decision, generally, that is going to be a bad outcome deliberately. They're not going to send someone off knowing that something's bad going to happen unless there are events that might make you change your mind.
Yeah.
But I love it. Look, for me, and we've got to wrap this up because otherwise it'll take up the whole episode. For me, currently, the number one storytelling game, full stop of the year for me. This is brilliant. I cannot wait to continue playing it. The mechanics of the game, what you do on every turn, you get the hang of it really quickly, but the story involved in this, and you compare the book of scripts that this has to the one in the Tales of the Arabian Nights, and they're just parallels apart. But this one, you want to pick up that book. You want to go to the chapter. You want to see what happens, good, bad, or otherwise, and you want to keep playing. I love this game. I'm so glad we have it in our collection, and man, just go out and find it. Just play it.
Yeah, look, even if you haven't played the computer game and you're intrigued by what we're saying and you're not sure, convince one of your friends to buy it and go and play it, because it's such an experience. I think it's well worth, you know, in terms of a game, it's relatively simple.
It is. And the little book that goes along with it, you hold the book and it tells you exactly these are the things you can do. So,
but the story it tells is just, as I said, it's riveting.
Yes. All right. We have to stop that because that's three quarters of the show already over. So that's the kind of conversation we're going to have about this game. So anyway, we're going to keep going. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for Area 52. We'll throw to another song. And then we're going to come back and talk about A Feast for Odin, which is another mammoth game, a little bit different to this one. You're with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM.
Garth, I've just heard some amazing news.
What?
There's going to be a brand new board game in the Terminator universe.
No, there isn't.
Yes, and believe it or not, it's in a part of the Terminator universe we've never really seen before, except for a couple of very brief glimpses in Terminator 2, the best of the Terminator movies.
Yeah, well, I hope it wasn't in Genesis.
No. We don't even count that one.
Good. What is it? Tell me more.
It's about 2029, which is not that far away, actually.
No.
And it's the war between the humans and the Skynet.
Humans and the machines.
That's right.
Just
saw very brief glimpses on.
Yeah.
Before Kyle Reese got sent back to the past and John Connor. No, he didn't get sent back. Oh, I'm getting so confused.
All right.
Anyway.
Just talk about this game,
this
Mark.
Game is about that war just before the humans are about to get wiped out.
What? That sounds horrible.
Well, you have to work together.
Okay,
because it's
good.
A co-op.
Yeah.
Because you can't trust the machines.
No.
So all the humans have to work together. And you have to hack into Skynet while at the same time you have to fight those crazy flying machines and the infiltrator Terminators that are trying to get into your squad because they look like humans.
That sounds way too hard for me.
Well, there's another thing though.
What?
You've got to hack into the T-800... Hasta la vista, baby. And send him back to save John Connor so that he's still alive in 2029, which is the future, but it's almost the present, to fight Skynet.
That's good. Is there any way I can actually look at this game?
Kickstarter.
Ah, I see.
It's a Kickstarter campaign with Rule and Make, Australia's premier design studio. And, Garth, you're never going to believe this.
What?
This game is designed by amazing, amazing game artist and graphic designer,
Ian O'Toole.
But he's actually designed this whole game. It's his first design.
He hasn't just done the pictures.
He actually hasn't done any of the pictures.
Wow, he's lost his touch.
No, because he's got Dan May, another fantastic Australian, to do all the art and graphic design. So this is like an all-Australian production, Australian art, Australian game designer, Australian company.
But not Australian theme.
Maybe Skynet gets launched here in Australia.
Oh, no!
Anyway, get on Kickstarter now. T2029. It's all happening on Kickstarter, and I can't wait to see what sort of like crazy stretch goals and things we're going to unlock. But it's going to have minis.
Yep.
It's going to have fighting, Skynet, dice.
Lots of dice, but it's dice manipulation, not dice rolling.
Ooh.
So it sounds, as you would say, interesting. Mm. You'll be backing it. All right, check it out on Kickstarter. Go to Rule and Make website. They'll have it. If you're really interested, just type in t2029.com for all the news, but go and spend your money on Kickstarter. It's out now.
I'll be backing it.
That was Maggie Kerner with The Birds here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh. Mark and Garth in the studio tonight, brought to you by Area 52. And always, always on Thursdays, it's comic book day.
Woo, maybe that's where Leon is.
It could be. Checking out those Image, that's the ones he loves.
Yeah, he said he was really sick with man flu, but I reckon he's probably in there just reading all of those comic books.
Anyway, now Garth, I've talked a lot tonight, particularly about this war of mine. Now, you're going to talk to us briefly about another game we played a little while ago.
Yeah, just a little game, just a light one, by our good friend Uwe Rosenberg, who you may remember has designed, let's just say, some seminal games.
Absolutely.
You read his description on Board Game Geek and it goes, he's probably best well known for Bonanza. And then you look at the games he's designed and you go, well, it depends what kind of gamer you are.
Yes, that's right.
So in order of rank, the most important games, according to the BGG community, Caverna, the cave farmers. Agricola,
yes.
Which has got to be one of the first and most impressive implementations of worker placement.
Well, it's when we were talking about This War of Mine and what a struggle it is, that was the other game that came to mind to me, the only other game where you feel like you're struggling to survive in a totally different way. But, you know, where you've got that each turn you're just struggling to get enough food for your family and literally that is all you can do sometimes.
Exactly. You've got Patchwork, you've got Fields of Arles, you've got Ora et Labora. Oh, my God, this guy knows how to design a game. But we're not going to talk about any of those except for A Feast for Odin, which is arguably one of the heaviest and biggest board game boxes, possibly except Twilight Imperium 3 and 4.
Yes.
Possibly Gloomhaven.
Yes.
But there wouldn't be many other boxes that are as meaty as heavy.
It's weighty, that's for sure.
Is it ever? So anyone who has played Agricola or Caverna would instantly feel at home in the mechanics of this game. The main difference is you're Vikings. You're not standard farmers trying to survive. You're not cave farmers trying to survive like you would be in Agricola and Caverna. You're Viking farmers trying to survive. But you're not really farmers. No, Vikings, and you are trying to get all the food and all the wealth and all the goods.
All the pillage.
All the pillage. So that you are the Viking with all of the least negative victory points.
That's right.
Because anyone who has seen a player board for A Feast for Odin will know that you start with your own player board, which has this lovely little sort of Viking village feel, where about two-thirds of it is made up of this big square that is all negative victory points.
Yeah, it looks very strange.
Oh, my God, is it strange. And it's very intimidating knowing that on turn one of this game, I'm starting on minus 100 points.
At least.
Minimum. What you are going to do in this game, very similarly to Agricola and Caverna, is start with a collection of workers. You will then have a plethora of choices of where you're going to place these workers.
So many choices.
Because the count I have heard, and I've not done this personally, is that there are 61 places for you to put your Viking meeples on the central action board.
There is a lot.
61.
Yeah.
Now, immediately I compare that with Agricola more than any other game, because Agricola, there are times when if you're playing a 3 or 4 player game, you've just got to do what you have to do because everyone else is taking the good spots. You're all bastards.
Yes.
Whereas this one, there's so many spots that you can place your Viking meeples on, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and it's way more Caverna in that way than Agricola, where it's just there's so many things you can do. What will I pick this time? As opposed to, oh, my God, I've got to do this. If I don't do this, I don't know how I'm going to survive.
And that is different. It's refreshing.
Yeah.
But for me, it's also not a good thing because I want to feel that stress. I want to feel that tension. I want to feel that how much it is to be first player is going to be critical in my turn because I want to get that one position, that one spot that is going to make all the difference to my particular turn and my strategy going forward.
And you certainly do discover that there are certain places that are desirable.
Yes.
One that sticks out to me is like the Wailing One because it lets you get a heap of meat.
Yep.
And some other stuff that I don't remember. Or, you know, whether you're going to make a hair shirt or you're going to skin a ferret or, you know, you're going to milk a cow or all those sort of things. There were, I'd say maybe only even two or three that were really desirable and they were the ones whoever went first would take those ones pretty much.
Yeah. So before we get to the second sort of part of this game, if we talk about the worker placement side of things, the 61 actions, look, they look daunting when you just see this central player board and go, where the hell do I start?
Oh, yes.
But once it's explained to you and you see that all of them on the left-hand column, they're all single meeple actions. The one next to that is all two meeples, then three meeples and four. And then if you look across the board horizontally, all of these actions relate to going hunting.
Yeah.
And these ones are going to the markets, or these ones all involve going to the mountains and getting your basic resources of wood and stone and coal.
Yeah.
And these ones are the pillaging actions, and these ones are your emigration actions. And you certainly start to compartmentalize it and go, on my turn, I really want to focus on getting more resources. Yeah. So I'll focus on going to the mountains and getting wood and stone and coal. Or I've got enough of those, I'll go and get some food. So I'll go to the farm or I'll go to the market or I'll go whatever.
I'll do some of those. Because I've got all those things now, I'm going to do the artisan type actions where I turn those things into
other
things.
You'll be able to upgrade. So I'll be able to take my bucket of milk somehow and turn it into a jumper.
Piece of whale meat.
So anyway, there are a plethora of actions that you'll be able to do on your turn. This game does go from 1 to 4, so you can play it solo, Mark, should you desire.
Yeah, I don't know that.
But that is the first part of this game where you're just going to do your very well-known Uber worker placement, send your people off to do things. Personally, probably the most interesting part of that for me is either the hunting, as you say.
Yes.
Or the emigration and the pillaging side of things, where you're going after these really cool, large, intricately shaped pieces of jewellery and pillaging or rewards that you've gotten for going to various places and doing really nice things with rival tribes.
It looks like you've sort of gone off to the Holy Land and stolen all the holy relics.
Exactly.
And they're all crazy shapes, and you first, of course, you look at those crazy shapes and go, why are they all crazy shapes?
Yeah. So anyway, that takes us to the second part of this game, which is why it is affectionately known by a lot of people as Viking Tetris.
Yes, that's right.
And that comes down immediately when you look at your player boards, because your player boards, as well as having half of the board or a third of the board being where your meeples will be, how you'll feed the meeples, mm-hmm. where you'll grow your animals and where you'll put some ships if you want to go hunting or whaling or expeditions, for example.
Yeah.
But the bulk of it is this big grid with all those horrible, horrible negative victory points, and that's where you're going to have to store your stuff. So that's where you keep your green items and your blue items that you've been able to get, because all of the little cards, the little chits and what have you, are double-sided and double-coloured. So you might have the food items, which are on one side orange, on the other side are red when you've upgraded them. They can't go in there. No, don't be stupid. They can't go in this place that cover all the victory points. It's only your green and your blue things, which are the slightly more hard to get, the slightly more valuable part of the components, and they are your loot and ultimately your victory points. And you will spend a bit of time in your solo puzzle trying to figure out how the hell to fit all of these things into your, at the start of the game, overwhelmingly large empty space, I guess.
Yes.
But very quickly, in so many Uber games, it'll ramp up and ramp up and ramp up, and you'll have no space for anything. You'll run out of space, and you will be going, oh, my God, I want to go and pillage that thing, but that thing's the wrong shape, so it won't fit in here. And it becomes a really challenging individual puzzle that isn't as evident in a lot of his other games, I don't think.
I must admit, I could never imagine at the start of the game, when looking at that board with so much empty space, that at the end of the game I would have to pick and choose what I was getting based on only having a tiny bit of space left. And I guess part of that was because not being familiar with the game.
Of course.
Part of that was because we didn't really understand the game enough where you get to bring those extra spaces on the islands.
The islands, or even the houses that you get to have. Yeah. So there is a crap load going on in this game. Mm. And if you're a fan of Uber, go and try it. It is not going to be for everybody, I don't think, because for people who have played Agricola and Caverna, there'll be a lot of similarities. There'll be a few differences that you'll probably end up picking a favorite.
Mm.
See, for me, I love Agricola because no other game, possibly bar this War of Mine, makes it harder to feed your people.
Yep.
And you are just solely focused on how do I get that pumpkin or how do I get a vegetable or how do I milk a cow or whatever. I just, Caverna, it's not such a challenge to feed your people.
Oh, and I'd love to disagree with you, Garth, but unfortunately, I'm also an Agricola person because Agricola, I remember talking about it and describing it as you feel like you've just maybe shifted your car into second gear and the game is finishing, whereas in Caverna, there's so much you can do. You've got so much, many more opportunities to build the engine and to have it humming along at top speed and pumping out stuff all over the place. And I guess that's also what's happening here in these final turns, where you're pumping out stuff all over the place to put all over the board.
So, look, it is a logical progression. I think, for anyone who has played Agricola and Caverna to go and have a feast for Odin. I know that a lot of Uwe fans went out and bought this because it was hype train.
Yes.
A new big Uwe worker placement game. And then they played it. And then they sold it because they were happy with Agricola or Caverna.
Yeah.
It wasn't different enough. It has a lot of fans, don't get me wrong. But for me, I'll happily play Agricola any day of the week.
And is it, what am I thinking of? Cottage Garden, is that the sort of like the quicker two-player version, the which is sort of encapsulates the Tetris-y part of this game?
Yeah,
I think,
but there's also
it?
Patchwork.
Or that, maybe that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, so Patchwork is his lighter game that sort of introduced this Tetris-y style mechanic. And then you've got A Feast for Odin, which takes that and adds it. So, yeah, I don't know whether I would go and play this again if it was sitting next to Agricola or Caverna. I think my heart lies with those two.
And I know, I remember talking to Karen.
Ah, yes.
A good friend of the show from Melbourne who helped us through the first part of this game and then left us to our own devices. Damn you, Karen! You know, she's a huge Uwe Rosenberg fan. She's always teaching the various Uwe games at all sorts of game conventions. I know I'm sure she said, you know, she could happily just play this one till the end of her days. Hopefully that's a long time away, because she just loved it so much. And it really, for her, it was all the Uwe stuff that she loved. Whereas for me, you're right, I'd rather, I mean, there's so much more game in Agricola still that I haven't even touched on, like the various different
the various decks. Yeah.
And how they change it up. I really even haven't started exploring that. So for me, look, if I never played this one again, I wouldn't be missing anything.
No, I just think, yeah, Agricola. And look, I own Caverna. I don't own Agricola.
Yeah.
I want to try Caverna again. I've only probably played it four times.
Yeah.
I would like to give that a go. But even the difference in the amount of actions you can do versus Agricola and Caverna, I want to feel that tension, and I don't think any other Uwe game does it as well as Agricola.
Yeah, it's that okay. Simple. Wow. Well, look, we've only got a couple more minutes, surprise, surprise, till the end of the show, and I had a whole bunch of news that I was going to share, but I think I'll just limit it to this one. Did you know, Garth, that, and don't ask me how this ties into board games, but hey, I found it interesting, there's a whole wiki page on the Disney wiki of the names that they didn't use for the seven dwarves. Because, of course, in the Grimm Brothers fairy tale, the dwarves didn't have names. And, of course, famously in Disney, they did get named. Some of the names they didn't use, these sounded like names of other dice men. There was Gloomy, Blabby, Flabby, Cranky, Dippy, Dirty, Deffy, Woeful, Awful, Tubby, Sneezy, Wheezy, Strut, Slutty, and it's really in there. This is from the 30s. Nifty, Jaunty, Chesty, Burpy, Blady, Biggy Wiggy, and Biggy Ego.
Who's that?
I kid you not.
Wow. Okay, well, maybe that can be, I don't know, an expansion for some seven dwarfs game. That's horrible.
Anyway, we have run out of time again.
Wow.
We've talked about two immense games. We'll be back next week to give you all the news that we didn't get to talk about tonight. But in the meantime, look, play lots more games. Play these games we talked about. They are great, particularly this War of Mine.
Oh, my God.
And look, thanks again to Area 52 for their support for us. Get in and check out their games, their comics, their Funko Pops, their anime, and everything else they've got. And we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, offering comics, books, card games and board games for the whole family. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au. And find us online at thedicemencometh.com.